Smith, I've turned on the internet broadcast. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'll reconvene the hearing. It's 1:30. Mr. Robert Jones was on the stand, and I don't see him.
Excuse me.
Okay.
Yep, there we go.
So, yeah, I think he might have just went out in the hall for a second.
I don't think it was anything I said that caused him to take off.
No. Mr. Jones has re-entered the room and taken the stand. You're still under oath, Mr. Jones. Commissioners, are you done with your questions? Redirect, Mr. Kennecke, if any.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Jones, you recall the testimony before the break regarding the liabilities of TransCanada Keystone?
Yes.
Or spills or other incidents?
Yes.
In your opinion, would TransCanada Corporation be able to continue to operate as a pipeline company if it walked away from a major liability incurred by an operating a pipeline subsidiary?
No. TransCanada is a pipeline company. We have to honor all these liabilities for all these operations because that's the business we're in. We just couldn't continue to operate if we were to do otherwise.
Thank you. I have nothing further.
Recross.
Just a few more questions. When you, Commissioner Hansen was questioning you, you talked about the coating that's factory installed, I understand, on the pipe.
That's correct.
But the joints are done in the field, is that right?
That's not completely correct. half the joints are done probably right after the mill, unless they're the ones from India, then the ones coming off the tankers will be done at a plant in the United States. We call it double jointing. So half the joints are done in the plant, and then they're coated, and then put on site on the right away, and then the remainder of the pipeline's put together.
The stuff that's done on site, is that somehow painted on? Is that the way it...
The details of the application for the epoxy can be best, the technical details on how the epoxy is applied can be best answered by Ms. Kathari.
You were asked by Commissioner Johnson about densitometers, and I guess if there aren't any in South Dakota, why was that even referenced in your direct testimony?
But, you know, I'm it shouldn't have been. We don't have any densitometers in South Dakota.
So your testimony, paragraph 10 on page 4, there will be above ground facilities, including 4 pump stations, isolation valves, and densitometers. And that's just simply not correct as it applies to South Dakota, correct?
Yes.
you were asked some questions about the wall thickness, the 0.72 versus the 0.80. And I think you said it was increased in certain areas, such as when it goes under roadways. Is that right?
No. The code requires you to design a pipeline different in certain areas, such as, for example, a road crossing. So when that occurs, when the code is instructing you to do that, the wall thickness does change in that one specific location I described.
Does it also increase where it crosses or goes under the Missouri River?
I believe so. Again, I'm not the expert witness on the different locations where the wall thickness increases, but I believe that's correct.
Who would be the person that knows the most about that?
I think it would be a number of people. I'm thinking that both Mira and Buster will know the answer to that question.
The primary reason for asking for the special permit so as to allow the thinner walled pipe was an economic one, correct?
It also allows the pipeline to have the same standard from start to finish.
Costs less, though, doesn't it?
There is a savings in weight. We had additional conditions. The net is a savings in acquisition of steel, which is a very high commodity component of the project.
I think that's all I have.
Any other recross?
No.
Hearing none. Do you have a question, Mr. Holland?
I have one question. In your earlier statement about why in response to one of the commissioner's questions, why there may be locations where you thicken the wall, as a road, for example, or crossing a railroad, you said that it was because it might be an area where there would be a lot of activity with digging. A backhoe you wouldn't want a backhoe to puncture the wall. Is that correct? Did I rephrase it correctly?
Certainly, there are areas along the route where the pipeline will have different wall thickness, and I believe one of them is railway crossings and road crossings.
And did you say, did I hear you correctly to say that the reason you might want to make that thicker there was in the event that somebody, if there's a lot of activity in that area, such as digging, that it would be stronger and it would withstand a strike of a backhoe tooth?
My understanding and the justification of the code, that increased activity is a result of a change in wall thickness.
So a water line that might be buried parallel to a fence, parallel to a road, a water line that might need to be dug up to fix a leak, which is a water line that might be buried 6 feet deep, wouldn't that be a potential area where you might need to have thicker pipe?
Again, the actual locations for wall thickness changes is one of code, and the reasons and where it is probably best answered by Buster, Mr. Gray.
Thank you.
You may step down. Call your next witness, Mr. Kennedy.
We'll call Mr. Koski to the stand. Thank you.
The reporter needs to swear you.
Would you state your name and business address for the record, please?
My name is Michael Koski, and my business address is 1300 Metropolitan Boulevard, Suite 200, Tallahassee, Florida.
What's your role with the TransCanada Keystone Project?
I'm the project director of the consulting technical team assigned for the U.S. portion of the pipeline facility of the Keystone Project, responsible for engineering, environmental permitting, and land acquisition.
Did you provide testimony in this matter?
Yes, I did.
I believe on the stack to your left there, you should find that testimony. I apologize for not having it out for you.
That's okay. I'll let it go. Yes, I found it.
Did you find both of them? Thank you.
Yes, I have.
Do you have any additions or corrections to that testimony?
Yes, I do.
And are you responsible for the routing of the pipeline through South Dakota?
Yes, I'm responsible for managing the team that conducted the routing.
Have you made route changes since the application was filed in April?
Yes, we have.
Good. I'm showing you what I've marked as Exhibit TC9. Are you familiar with that exhibit?
Yes, I am.
Have you seen it before?
Yes, I have.
Was it prepared under your direction?
Yes, it prepared by the team formed under my direction.
Can you tell us what that is?
It's a number of variations that have occurred to the alignment of the project since the application was filed in South Dakota in April.
Are those changes the ones that were responded to in Webb Water's interrogatories answered last week?
Yes, I believe so.
I'd ask that TC9 be admitted at this time as changes and corrections to the maps, which were put on in with the application and put in as part of Mr. Koski's testimony.
Those are the ones that were attached to the interrogatory.
Yes, exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. I have no objection.
Objections from anyone else? Hearing none, Exhibit TC9 is admitted.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Koski, I've put in front of you what we've marked as Exhibit TC-10.
Yes.
Have you seen that before?
Yes, I have.
Can you tell us what it is?
Yes, these are additional changes to the alignment in South Dakota that have been adopted since the response to the interrogatory mentioned previous. However, there is one within this package that was included in the interrogatory, Route Variation 293.
293 was included in the interrogatory?
Yes, it's in both packages.
Oh, I apologize. Thank you for pointing that out. So how many are in TC9 as you have it there?
I have 15 in my package.
And then how many in TC-10?
There are three, but there's a duplicate with TC-9.
Thank you. Which page in TC-10 is the duplicate, do you know?
The second page.
Okay. Can you remove that, please, from TC-10?
Me?
Yes, please.
Okay.
So would you recite the numbers, please, or the identifying marks on the first page of TC-10?
Route Variation 292.
And then the second page of TC-10?
Route variation 294.
And the third page. Is there no third page?
There's no longer a third page.
Got it. Thank you. Can you describe what's shown on 292, please?
On 292, the red line that's shown was the original route as filed in the application in April, and the yellow line is a reroute that has since been adopted.
And 294, same?
The same.
Are you familiar with the landforms or the areas that are depicted on either of those pictures?
I don't have personal knowledge of the specific landforms or the routing associated with either of these.
Okay. I'd ask that both pages of TC-10 be admitted as evidence.
Objection?
No objection.
TC-10 is admitted.
Mr. Costa, do you have any other additions or corrections to your testimony that you're aware of?
No, I do not.
Are you responsible for the creation and preparation of the draft environmental impact statement?
I'm responsible for supporting the preparation of the draft environmental impact statement. The draft environmental impact statement was prepared by the Department of State and their third-party contractor. I'm responsible for Keystone's supply of information to that process to support the preparation of that document.
Where are we at in that process? Where is Keystone at in the DEIS process?
Well, certainly the DEIS has been out for some time now. DEIS comment period has been completed. The Department of State is in the preparation of preparing the final environmental impact statement, and as was stated earlier by Mr. Jones, well, we certainly expect the FEIS by the end of the year.
Oh, if you'll allow me just a minute, thank you. Excuse me a minute. Mr. Koski, I've put in front of you a binder containing a large document, and we've marked it as TC-15. Are you familiar with that document?
Yes. In the absence of the cover page, it appears to be the draft environmental impact statement.
Can you take a minute and ensure that it's there in its complete form to the best of your knowledge?
Sure. I do note the third page of this document contains something that is not part of the DEIS.
Please remove it.
story. I'm not going to read it. Yes, it appears to be the draft environmental impact statement.
Are you sure that there's no other pages in there? I just want to make sure.
Well, I haven't looked at every page, but...
So we better look at them all, I think.
If you're wrong, we'll have to charge you with perjury.
That's certainly my fear. It is lacking the appendices, from what I can tell.
This is an official government record, is it not?
It is.
I mean, if it's not, you know, it is what it is. And if the exhibit has got mistakes in it, I think we can correct that.
All right. It appears to be a draft environmental impact statement without the attachments.
I guess it's obvious where I'm headed. I'd like this to be introduced. Can we stipulate to the introduction of the draft environmental impact statement?
Yeah, I don't think we'll have a problem with that, except I guess in light of the fact things have been removed from it.
Yeah, obviously. We want to
look at it. I guess conditionally I'd say I don't object, but that's subject to us having a chance to look at that notebook.
Well, I think what we want to have is an accurate copy of the draft environmental impact statement. If it isn't that, then that's the document we ought to have in the record. Is that a fair statement?
I agree, yes.
Staff does not object to admission of the draft environmental impact statement.
Okay, so ultimately we'll ensure that that's what's in the record.
Okay, and are you going to offer, or would you like the attachments to the draft environmental impact statement? Are they the same things that we have in the...
Yes, I believe everybody's... I'm being advised not now. Exactly. That's where we're headed, I think, is the stipulation of the introduction of the entire draft environmental statement with the attachments as it's on record with the Department of State.
Okay. Thank you.
And we'll not introduce TC-15 then. Mark that TC-15. Very well.
Is that acceptable?
I'm not sure exactly what we're doing now.
Yeah, well, I'm not either. So,
I think the idea is there. I mean, the document that I believe he wants introduced is the actual official record copy with the Department of State of the DEIS. Is that correct?
Exactly correct.
And it is what it is. It's an official document of the United States government.
It is, and ultimately we'll produce that as TC-15.
Which will have all the attachments then.
Correct, with all the attachments, indeed.
That's fine.
I apologize to everybody.
Well, it isn't like we don't have a little bit of paper here to shuffle. Are there any objections to that, to the admission of the DEIS?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Then TC-15 is admitted. Which will consist of the actual record copy, of a copy of the official DEIS on file with the Department of State.
Well, we'll tender the witness for cross-examination at this time.
Mr. Rasmussen,
please
proceed.
Mr. Koski, I'm going to ask you about the route changes, first of all.
Mr. Rasmussen, your microphone again. Sometimes we get complaints from folks on the Internet. Thanks.
People are complaining they can't hear me?
Well, not specifically yet, but I'm trying to head that off at the pass. All right. So.
I'll try to talk into it. Looking at Exhibit 9, TC9, that would be the first set of aerial photographs. I think it'd be the second page if my pages are the same. Well, I guess I'm not sure. I'm looking at Route 231. It's a reroute to avoid NRCS easement. Do you know which one I'm referring to?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, just looking through the ones I have, I don't see a reference to 231. We have a document that was given to us with our interrogatory answers that make a reference to Route 231 SD10221.5-1, and it says reroute to avoid NRCS easement. Is there a corresponding photograph with that?
I don't see that in my package.
Do you know what where that was?
No, I don't.
You made the comment that that you didn't have personal knowledge about these route changes. Is that right?
Yes, I lead a team that consists of numerous personnel representing various disciplines that participate in the evaluation and participate in the route refinement process, including the evaluation of possible reroutes or refinements.
So if I wanted to know about specific changes, who would be the person to ask about that?
I would suggest most of them would have to be deferred to Buster Gray.
Because okay. I think the prior witness, Mr. Jones, indicated that you would be the one, but that's...
Mr. Jones relies on me to put a team in place to conduct certain activities, one of which is route refinement, and I've delegated the management of that particular component of that exercise to Buster Gray.
All right. I'll defer my questions to him then. Looking then at your direct testimony, page 3 makes reference at the top of the page to shifts in the route to the west to avoid crossing environmentally sensitive areas consisting of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service grassland easements. Why is a grassland easement area environmentally sensitive?
Well, I think it's been recognized that native prairies and grassland are an important resource. And in early routing activities associated with the Keystone Project, we had routed through an area that had some areas of grasslands that were protected by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service easements for the sole purpose of protecting these grassland areas. And again, that's the type of information you receive as you work through the route refinement process where you are dealing with increasing levels of information. And those were brought to our attention by the Fish and Wildlife Service. They're not published and they're not part of any particular public database. And we incorporated them into the route selection process and have routed to avoid them.
Some of these areas are basically just pasture land, are they not?
I'd have to defer the exact definition of a grassland to Scott Ellis, who will testify later.
Did the U.S. Fish and Wildlife tell you that they were not going to let you put the pipeline in any grassland easement areas under their control?
I don't recall if those specific words were used, but certainly it was a resource that they had undertaken to protect through the formalization of a conservation easement on the property. And certainly they were interested in protecting them.
So the pipeline was then moved off of the grassland easement areas onto other private land, is that right?
Yes.
Page 3 of your testimony also talks about Raymond Prairie Chicken Lex. Is that how you say that?
Yes, it is.
What is that?
I should defer the specific definition of a prairie chicken lek, but it is important habitat, obviously important to prairie chickens.
All right. And so that there was some area that caused the pipeline to be moved away from the prairie chicken place.
Yes.
Okay. Did Mr. Jones say that you were the HCA expert, or the one to address that?
Yes, but I am not the HCA expert. Heidi Tilquist, who will testify later, is the expert associated with high consequence areas.
You were probably cringing with Mr. Jones was giving his testimony then about all your expertise. Is that right?
I was certainly rehearsing that response.
Okay. Paragraph 26 of your testimony on page 9 talks about subsistence risk related to earthquakes. Are you aware of there being a history of earthquake activity in both Yankton County and in the Britton area?
I'm not aware of that personally. A professional geologist prepared this response in my direction.
Who was that?
The particular individual who participated in this was Henry Friedenberg of my Tallahassee office.
Okay. He's not testifying?
He is not.
Right. And you don't have personal knowledge then of that subject either?
No, I don't.
What was the document that was in the notebook that you said was not part of the EIS that was removed?
It was the summary of anticipated annual Trans-Canada Keystone Pipeline South Dakota ad valorem property tax impact that you have discussed previously.
Okay, that was the earlier exhibit 14, I think.
Yes.
All right. And obviously that would have nothing to do with the EIS.
It does not.
I have no further questions.
Other intervener, cross-examination?
Kurt Hong. I have just two questions, I think. Your testimony refers to the decision made not to consider an I-29 route or an I-29 corridor. Is that correct?
I reference I-29 in here, yes.
Can you explain the reason, what went into that decision not to, it appears from your written testimony that it wasn't even approached. Can you explain how that decision was made, who was involved?
Sure. Certainly in the very early stages, as I believe was presented at the public sessions, when the route did not contemplate going to Cushing, Oklahoma, I, at that time, actually went through Iowa and went direct to Wood River, Illinois. There was an alternative considered that is presented in our application with the Department of State. One of the options did have a discrete section co-located with I-29, again, not within the right-of-way, but adjacent to it. That was discounted at that time for various reasons. When the project objectives were still the Wood River location and a point in Salisbury, Missouri. Subsequent to that, the need to service a market in Cushing, Oklahoma, became part of the mix, and this is described in that application to the DOS, which took I-29 out as an option for any alternative, simply because the project focus shifted further west, taking I-29 out of consideration.
You mentioned that the route, if it would have been considered, or in the preliminary when you had some thought of considering it, you were talking about putting it on private land, not in the road ditch right away.
That's correct.
Did you ever submit anything in writing to the South Dakota Highway Department and ask if you could place a pipe in that right-of-way?
No, we have not.
You have not?
No.
Are you aware of whether they have allowed other pipelines to be built within state road right-of-way?
I'm aware of one discrete case, as communicated by the South Dakota Department of Transportation, where they allowed a pipeline to traverse a very short section of their right-of-way on the backside of an off-ramp, to facilitate a better crossing location. I do not have specific knowledge of which pipeline or where that was. That was a comment made by South Dakota DOT. And at the same time, they said they would not allow a pipeline such as the Keystone Project to be located within their easement.
Would it surprise you if there were a petroleum pipeline located in a state road highway right-of-way?
A state road or an interstate?
Well, the state manages the interstate highway system here in the state. They maintain it. They're responsible for it. We call it a state highway or a federal highway.
My comments relate to interstate limited access highways. Freeways is commonly referred to.
But let me rephrase the question. Have any information from the South Dakota Department of Transportation, who manages the interstate highways and state highways in South Dakota, that they would not allow you to consider placing part or all of the pipeline in the I-29 road ditch?
Personal communication from the South Dakota Department of Transportation indicated they would not allow a project such as Keystone longitudinally within an interstate highway right-of-way.
You have nothing in writing on that? It's a verbal or a...
It's a verbal.
On page 8 of your testimony, item 22, it would be the second bullet from the bottom. Keystone did not consider locating the pipe within the I-29 corridor due to safety issues and the impediment the facility could create to highway maintenance and expansion. Are you aware of highway expansion out there that we're not aware of, or is that highway likely to expand?
Well, I believe the bullet you're referring to says Keystone rejected the option of locating adjacent to the I-29 right-of-way for the following reasons. If you're referring to the second bullet?
I'm sorry, the first bullet. Second from the bottom up is what I meant. The first bullet on page, at the bottom, under item 22, page 8.
Yes.
Could you read that and then... Tell me.
Keystone did not consider locating the project within the I-29 corridor, as this is not allowed due to safety issues and the impediment the facility would create to highway maintenance and expansion.
Safety issues. Here's the question, I guess. There are a lot of pipelines installed in road ditches in this state and other states. In fact, petroleum lines. It's a wide right-of-way. It's wider than what you have that you're asking for. Was that really a reason conveyed by the state, or was that your company's decision or reason?
The state specifically mentioned safety concerns as outlined in this testimony, and as far as their maintenance and expansion needs, they also stated that as an issue, but I'm not aware of any specific expansion plans. I'm sure they are.
Well, being the person in charge or responsible for supervising the designation of a route, you obviously weigh all various factors, safety, constructability, and so forth. Was the I-29 corridor avoided because state officials thought it wouldn't be safe to have an oil line along an interstate highway?
That's certainly one of the factors. Another more compelling factor is it does not go where we want to go.
The state of South Dakota, under someone's signature, could grant you an easement to construct in their right-of-way with one signature granting that.
Well, I object. There's no foundation for that.
I'm asking about route, Mr. Chairman.
I guess, Mr. Hone, I work for a telephone company for 15 years with an interstate separating two different telephone companies, and you put an interduct underneath the interstate, yes, you could. But that's it. Otherwise, you could not bury the cable along the interstate. They would not let you. Is that kind of what you're fishing for?
Well, what I'm wondering about is did the State Highway Department specifically say no, or was it their decision not to route there? Yes or no?
We decided not to route there because it is not consistent with the objectives of the project. However, in doing the usual assessment that's part of any route selection process, communications did take place with the state of South Dakota, and they confirmed what is certainly common practice throughout the U.S., that projects such as this are not allowed within interstate rights of way.
Well, one last question then regarding the routing. When you look at routing, you also look at access for maintenance, constructability, and emergency response, correct?
Those are considerations, yes.
Would the routing of this pipeline along Interstate 29 offer a better emergency response access than in a remote area in Marshall and Clark County?
I would have to defer emergency response planning to Brian Thomas.
Thank you.
Do other interveners have any questions? Staff?
Thank you. Just real quick, staff wonders if the application will be amended to reflect the route changes in TC-09 and TC-10.
You and I can talk about that later as a matter of legality, but I don't know that it's proper for Mr. Koski to answer that. Okay. Would that be all right?
Mm, that's fine.
Is that all? Commissioners, do you have questions of Mr. Koski? Commissioner Hansen?
Good afternoon, Mr. Koski.
Hi.
After looking at the information that was passed around here, I know that a number of the citizens appreciate the changes that took place after looking at some of the aerial photos and seeing them running through farmsteads and backyards of houses and things of that nature. I'm sure it creates a lot less consternation than they did previously. Can you tell us, are you aware of any other outstanding concerns by property owners as to the routing of the pipeline on property that they own as opposed to someone else owns?
I'm not personally aware of outstanding property-specific routing concerns. However, I will add that the process of negotiating easements with landowners, and even before that process, there's ample opportunity afforded to solicit the type of input from landowners along the lines of what you're suggesting, and we work to incorporate that sort of input into the route refinement process. And to the extent we can accommodate specific requests such as that, we do.
Thank you. And page 6 of your testimony on question 17, You were asked if it was your opinion that the proposed location of the Keystone Pipeline has a minimal adverse effect on the environment, natural resources, citizens of South Dakota. Your answer was yes. What are some of those minimal adverse effects on the environment, natural resources, and the citizens?
The specific adverse effects, I believe, will be testified to by Scott Ellis later on, and has been included in the South Dakota application. I guess I'd like to point out that the selection of a route must balance numerous, often competing interests associated with natural resources, private landowner desires, safety and reliability, and that process of route selection incorporates and balances all of those factors, and routing decisions have to be made with a consideration for all of them, not just for one particular issue.
Thank you. Digesting your answer means that you take into consideration the damages that could occur and the challenges to property owners, and examine what is in the best interests of the pipeline as well as the property owners.
Yes, and the mitigation that can be applied and committed to minimize those effects.
In doing so, do you place the property owners at the top of the list of concerns, or is there a prioritization there? It sounds as if when you said there's a balancing.
Yeah, there's not a formalized prioritization. I mean, every situation is different. And that's where having the procedures in place to evaluate all the aspects come into play, and it also the importance of having a multidisciplinary team of people reviewing that so that no one person does it in isolation is critical to treating every situation as it should be.
Thank you.
Other commissioner questions?
Thanks, Mr. Smith. Mr. Koski, my question deals with control points, which you described as the first task in selecting a route through South Dakota. You note that the southern control point was the Missouri River near Yankton.
Yes.
And then you gave some rationales for why that was selected as a control point. Were there other southern control points considered?
The Missouri River crossing, there was basically three general locations that were considered. Major river crossings, as you point out, do often form control points at fixed portions of the route, and the Missouri was certainly one that was recognized very early on as being one of those. And the three alternative locations considered on a general sense were upstream or west of Yankton, crossing one of the Gavin's Point Reservoir, because it was outside of the special designated reach of the river. That reservoir impoundment is not actually part of the designation. So we looked at that to be out of that special recreational designation from the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. We, of course, looked at Yankton because of existing bridge crossings and two existing pipeline crossings and a relatively narrow reach of the river. And we also looked downstream of the special designated area, downstream or east of Ponca State Park. And Yankton was selected as the preferred location, mainly because it's co-located with existing utilities that cross. It's a relatively stable section of the river. There's obviously other interests that are interested in keeping it in the location it's at. The topography is favorable on both sides for the preferred approach of a directional drill, and the directional drill can accomplish the crossing in one installation. And that crossing, that drill passes under not only the river but also the jurisdictional limits of the National Park Service in their jurisdiction under the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act.
Do co-location opportunities for these, directional drilling, I mean, does that come with additional risk with regard to third-party damage?
You mean during the installation of our pipeline?
Well, no. I actually mean that if there are two already, if Keystone were to become the third and it becomes a place where pipelines co-locate often, if there's a fourth pipeline and they're directionally drilling, does that raise the likelihood that there could be some third-party damage to the what would be existing Keystone pipeline?
I guess there would be a remote possibility that there could be some interaction from a new installation with existing pipelines, but I will say the directional drilling technology and the contractors that are employed in it are highly skilled. The technology is very advanced, and the progress of the drilling operation is monitored continuously. It is always known where it is downhole, so there's very little risk of running into something that you know is there, just because it's monitored continuously.
Are you familiar with the property ownership along the I-29 corridor adjacent to the right-of-way that was briefly considered by TransCanada Keystone?
No, I'm not familiar with it.
Okay. That's all I have.
Other commissioner questions? Any redirect?
No, thank you.
Any questions responsive to the commissioner's questions?
Just one question. Was the in determining the Yankton site, was it the fact that the Lewis and Clark intake for its water system is located downstream, did that play any part in determining the location?
No, it did not.
Thank you.
Any other cross-examination?
Again. I have one question regarding your crossing at Yankton. If I'm viewing the picture right, this is right at the river, and this would be Exhibit 10. The red line and the yellow line, is the red line the original route?
Yes, it is.
And the yellow line is the new route?
Yes, it is.
I stayed at both places, and I may have the names reversed, but there's near the yellow line, there's two hotels, and you're going right between the two. Is that correct?
That's what it indicates here. I don't have personal knowledge of this route variation.
The federal regulations say that wherever possible, you try to stay with at least 50 feet away from a private dwelling or a place like a hotel where there may be a lot of people staying. Would you have the red line is routed along 104 or 1004, 1005, 1006, 1007. Those are all warehouse facilities and offices. Do you know why that route is changed?
I do not know why the route is changed. However, I do know that there have been discussions ongoing with the city of Yankton to accommodate its expansion plans, and we've been working with the city engineer on locating a facility that's consistent with their planned development.
Well, then one last question on this. Were you rerouted between the two hotels? I believe one's a Super 8 and the other one is possibly a Best Western. Do you make the pipe thicker? Do you build the pipe thicker in that area?
I would have to defer that question.
Thank you.
Any follow-up, Mr. Kennecke?
No, thank you.
You're excused. Sherry, how are we doing? Mr. Kennecke, you want to call your next witness?
We'll call Scott Ellis to the stand. Thank you. State your name and business address for the record, please.
My name is Scott Ellis. My business address is 1601 Prospect Parkway, Fort Collins, Colorado.
Are you employed or engaged by the Keystone Pipeline in some capacity?
Yes. I'm responsible for collecting information that was then entered into permit applications for both federal and state permit applications.
Can you briefly state your educational and professional background for us?
I'm currently a project manager for ENSER, a consulting engineering and environmental engineering company, and I have been a project manager for the last 20 years or so, primarily in the area of pipeline projects as well as other industrial facilities, and I'm a graduate of Cornell University.
Did you provide written testimony that was pre-filed in this matter?
Yes.
On the stack there to your left, did you find that on the top?
I do.
Do you have any additions or corrections to that testimony?
I do not.
If I asked you each of the questions contained in that document again, would you answer as you did in writing?
Yes.
Handed you what I've marked as TC-12. Are you familiar with that document?
I would have to look at it for a moment. I'm not familiar with it.
Perhaps if you'd look at
I'm looking. It appears to be that this is has been copied from the application.
And doesn't it constitute changes to some of the acreages contained in the application?
If I could take a moment, I'd like to quickly compare.
You may.
So I've examined, compared the two, and they are different, and the exhibit updates, the disturbance estimates that were provided in the application.
Can you tell us what the changes are, please?
In the original application, the estimate was for construction of the pipeline would disturb approximately 2,169 acres, or 75% of the proposed corridor. In the update, it is that the pipeline would disturb approximately 2,504 acres, or 74% of the proposed corridor. And then there is a second section here, in which, if I could turn here, our original estimate was that the construction of the pipeline would disturb approximately 633 acres, or 21% of the proposed corridor of grassland and rangeland. It's kind of a combined land use category. And in the exhibit, it indicates that the pipeline would disturb approximately 679 acres, or 20% of the proposed corridor of grassland slash rangeland.
So does TC 12 then update correctly those disturbances to your knowledge?
Yes.
I'd ask that TC 12 be admitted as evidence.
Objection. Objection. TC 12 is admitted.
Do you know of any other additions or corrections to your testimony?
I have no other additions.
Okay. Oh, and your rebuttal testimony as well. Have you taken a look at it? R.
Yes.
And if I asked you each of those questions, would you answer the same way she did therein?
Yes.
Thank you. I have nothing further. I'll tender the witness for cross-examination.
Mr. Rasmussen, please proceed.
Mr. Ellis, take a look at paragraph 9 of your direct testimony.
Yes.
It talks about consultation with federal and state agencies, and among the agencies mentioned are the State Historical Society. What can you describe for me the nature of the consultation you had with the South Dakota State Historical Society?
To determine what types of cultural resource surveys, as well as the information needed to conduct those surveys, it was essential to conduct with the, consultations with that agency.
And what sort of cultural resource surveys were done?
Sort of from the beginning, there's a step that's it's called a record search, in which you were looking for previously recorded sites, which go into the development of what's called a research design, which is a document which is essentially a study plan for conducting what's called pedestrian surveys on the ground by qualified archaeologists.
It's my understanding some pipelines do a 100% pedestrian survey of proposed routes. Is that correct?
It depends upon what the State Historic Preservation authorizes the applicant to do. I mean, it depends on sort of, it depends on the project. It depends upon the types of environment that the pipeline is crossing, but there's not a fixed requirement to do a 100% survey.
How much of the South Dakota portion of the pipeline was, and I guess when we say pedestrian survey, that means the site is walked by somebody, is that right?
Correct. Okay.
How much of this pipeline route was actually walked by somebody?
If you don't mind, I'd like to refer to the direct testimony on that.
Sure. I think it's at paragraph 28, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. Direct testimony here states that approximately 38 miles of the proposed 219.9-mile route in South Dakota was selected for intensive pedestrian field survey.
Intensive pedestrian field survey, is there a non-intensive or?
No. Well, yeah. I think what it means is that it's what there's basic methods for people walking, what are called transects, and they walk at a relatively fixed distance so that they have a good survey area that they can, you know, with confidence see and determine if there are any artifacts on the ground. So it's a fairly systematic approach to looking for signs of cultural resources or artifacts.
If my math is right, 38 miles out of 219.9 is about 17%. Does that sound about right?
I think that's about right, yes.
Okay. You also state that you had consultation with the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. Can you describe the nature of that consultation for me?
I can describe the consultation that I was involved in. There may have been others whom I cannot characterize, but we held meetings with the DENR to identify the types of permits that would be needed in the state of South Dakota. These meetings were conducted in early 2006 as we were sort of, you know, bringing the project forward, and the DENR was invited to several meetings.
Who did you specifically meet with from DENR?
I'd have to follow up with meeting notes, but I don't have them in front of me here.
Do you remember any of the people that were involved?
Not with confidence, no.
Paragraph 10 of your direct testimony references, and it'll be on page 4, references Native American consultation. Can you describe that for me? Who was consulted with, and what was the nature of that consultation?
Well, the Native American consultation is primarily a consultation that takes place between the federal government and the tribes. And in this case, that consultation is being undertaken by the Department of State.
So Keystone itself, for you yourself, were not involved in any consultation with Native Americans?
I believe that our cultural resource contractors did send out letters simply stating that the project was undertaking this project, but then at a fairly short time after that, the Department of State took that whole program over, and the project has no longer had any direct communication with the tribes.
Are you aware of some concerns raised by Tim Mintz, the Standing Rock Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, and in correspondence that was submitted in connection with the development of the draft EIS?
I am not personally, no.
Were you aware that any such concerns were raised at all?
Yeah, I'm aware that there have been concerns, but I can't characterize them in detail.
Okay. Have those concerns been addressed in any manner?
To my knowledge, that those discussions are being ongoing between the Department of State and the tribes.
Paragraph 16 of your direct testimony states that approximately 5% of the overall project surface disturbance will affect highly erodible soils. What's the source of that statement?
I believe that it is a mapping of soils that are based on the Natural Resource Conservation Service maps that where the map units are then characterized in accordance by whether they're sorted by their erodibility and then grouped together to make estimates of their overall erodibility.
Is the crossing of highly erodible soils a concern?
It's a concern to the extent that they need to be planned for, yes.
What do you do to plan for it?
Well, we account for the fact that if there are, you know, both wind and water, there are certain measures during construction that you'd want to consider to protect topsoil when it's excavated and reapplied.
turn to paragraph 20 of your direct testimony on page 10. That references a June 8, 2006 letter from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Has that letter been filed in connection with this proceeding?
I believe it has. I believe that that letter was filed in conjunction with other materials that were filed with the Department of State, but in turn were also filed with the commission here.
Do you know where it would be or when it was? Would it be part of the draft EIS?
Well, I think it would have been part of the support materials. I believe it would have been Exhibit C. But where in Exhibit C, unfortunately, okay. I can't tell you. But
all right. It's in there somewhere, though. That's, yes. This mentioned that Fish and Wildlife, that letter had to do with the crossing of grassland and wetland easements in South Dakota. I think it was Mr. Koski said you would be the guy to define a grassland. So could you do that for me?
Well, I think that there's sort of two ways of looking at grassland in the context of the section here under 20. It's really an area that the Fish and Wildlife Service is interested in protecting, and they have protected them under what they call grassland easements. And some of these are, and for the most part they are, some of them are native grasslands, some are mixtures of former cropland and native grass, but by and large they are protecting them because they are primarily they're dominated by grass. So that's kind of that sort of definition as it relates to what the Fish and Wildlife Service is interested in. I think the other aspect of what we were looking at grasslands for was as support for some of the listed plant and animal species that are dependent on these types of native grasslands. We're calling them more undisturbed grasslands that have a very high percentage of native species in their composition.
What is the danger to a grassland from construction of a pipeline such as this? Why is Fish and Wildlife concerned about that?
I think largely that they're in areas that have sort of high composition or diverse composition of native plants are concerned about potential for weed invasion. They're concerned about just restoration of the species that were formerly there.
Would similar concerns with regard to weed invasion be true of any of the area where the pipeline is going to be installed?
Yes.
So private landowners would have the same type of concern that Fish and Wildlife would have in that regard?
That's possible, yes.
But they don't have, private landowners don't have the power like the government does to tell you to move the pipeline off of their land, correct?
Well, I don't know if it's a matter of moving the pipeline, but there are measures that can be applied to control weeds or at least look out for them, and again, plan to prevent weeds from being a problem. Okay.
But nevertheless, Fish and Wildlife still didn't want the pipeline going across its grassland easement land.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the Fish and Wildlife Service didn't prefer the pipeline on their grassland easements. They just simply stated that they would, that they would need to look at it in detail, and they would certainly want to see, what kinds of planning would take place before, as part of their review process and granting an easement across their lands.
So rather than go through that process, the decision was made to simply move the pipeline off of that land.
Well, I think in that sense, that's true. It was easier to go somewhere else.
Does the pipeline go across native grassland and private property that's not part of a government easement area?
Yes.
Are special things being done to protect that native grassland?
Well, I think what we're doing now is trying to narrow down the areas that are the highest quality, that are the most sensitive. And then I think what we're anticipating is probably a fairly detailed reclamation planning effort to identify the best way to get across those grasslands to minimize the loss of diversity and ensuring that they recover.
Do you know how many areas of native grassland or how much acreage we're talking about that the pipeline is going to cross?
What we've done is, you know, in sort of the course of our, both mapping effort and reconnaissance effort and some, and some ground survey effort for listed threatened endangered species, we've come up with, I would use, roughly 5 miles of very high quality native grassland on private lands that we would cross. And then I think the application says there's something like, at least as it's been modified by the response to the data request, about 12 miles. So I think the very best is somewhere in the realm of 5 miles.
Paragraph 21, and it's on page 11 that I'm questioning about, mentions 5 perennial streams are crossed by the proposed pipeline route, including the Missouri River. What's the definition of a perennial stream?
Well, pretty much means that water is running in it almost all the time. I think a number of these streams, although they're classified as perennial, tend to dry. They have very low flows at certain times of the year, but by and large, they are they flow well. They flow consistently enough to support a diversity of aquatic life.
And there's only 5 such streams along the entire route in South Dakota?
I think by the definitions that we were using in terms of looking at, supporting aquatic communities, I think that's the number we came up with.
And just so the definition that you use, is that some sort of federal definition or defined in the law somewhere, or is it Keystone's definition?
Well, I think in this case it's probably Keystone's definition.
And so just tell me again, what is the definition that you're using in this case of a perennial stream?
Well, I think we're using the definition, as I said earlier, of a consistent flow regime in that stream year-round, sufficient to maintain aquatic life, particularly fisheries.
And why is it significant? Why is a perennial stream significant to the project or the pipeline crossing it? Is that an area of higher danger or potential danger?
Well, it's just an area that, depending on the sensitivity of the resources in the stream, it requires planning to cross the stream, to construct the pipeline across the stream.
Do you know? We've heard testimony about some areas having thicker pipe. And I believe one of those areas being the Missouri River. Would the other perennial streams also be areas where the thicker pipe would be used?
I don't know the answer to that.
Not your area.
No, not my answer.
All right, that's fine. You go on in the next paragraph of paragraph 22 to talk about hydrostatic testing. And you say that'll have minor effects on the 5 perennial streams. How is the hydrostatic testing? Is when you test the pipeline with water after it's been completed, but before the product, the crude oil, actually starts going through it. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. How is that done?
Well, water is withdrawn from a water source and is placed in a section of a pipeline, and then the pipeline is pressurized with water up to a fairly high pressure, higher than typically you would be operating a pipeline at. And then you're testing, you hold it, and then determine whether there are any leaks in the pipeline, and then release it, and then put the water back in the stream.
How much water does that take to do that?
Well, it's very dependent on the amount of water and the number of water supplies. and it's just it's highly variable in terms of that volume.
And where do you get the water?
Well, I mean, there's a number of options for withdrawing hydrostatic test water. You can withdraw it from streams. You can withdraw it from wells. You don't have to. I mean, it's just you just have to have a water supply that's sufficient to do the testing that you need. And
it'll take quite a bit of water to test this entire pipeline, won't it?
Yes, and I think, again, it's about you have to put water, withdraw the water. You have to plan for it, and you have to put it back. And the amount of water you can use or to test a section is really dependent on how much is available. And I think it's really more kind of part of the construction planning. And at this point, I think I will defer a bit on this to Buster Gray to maybe give you some more, parameters that are considered in terms of selecting hydrostatic test sections.
Has the planning for the hydrostatic testing been done yet? Or is that something that is done later on?
Well, I think it's been done in a preliminary fashion. There's still, I think, still more work to be done.
But Mr. Gray would be the best one to talk about that?
I believe so.
Paragraph 23 references a biological assessment submitted to U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And it says that this Mr. Cochnar and his staff are currently reviewing a draft biological assessment, and that feedback to the Department of State in Keystone is expected by mid-October. Have you received that feedback?
Actually, it's some we have received some feedback, but we have not received all of it. But there's been further development of that biological assessment, but it's not, the process is not complete.
When will that process be completed?
We're anticipating that it would be completed sometime in the same time frame as the draft EIS is coming out.
Paragraph 24 mentions that no tribal or federal lands are crossed by the proposed route. Is there a reason for that? Was that a decision that by Keystone that we don't want to go across any tribal or federal lands, or is that just the way it worked out?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Paragraph 24 mentions that there are 18 residences within 500 feet of the proposed pipeline center line. Is that right? You see where I'm reading from?
Yeah, I'm trying to. Yes.
Okay.
It says that.
Do you know where those are? Those plotted out somewhere, or do you know how far from the pipeline those is? Are they 20 feet or 500 feet? Do you know?
Well, they're 500 feet or more. It's really kind of, I believe, it says within 500.
So it'd be 500 or less, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you're right. You're correct.
Do you know what the closest one is?
I don't.
What's the, is there some magic about the 500 feet?
No, just to seem to give kind of a reference of, just sort of what is a, it's some sort of a benchmark of distance from the pipeline in terms of where people are living.
Is there any distance that you won't allow the pipeline, let's say 50 feet away or 100 feet away, or anything like that? A residence has to be more than a particular distance away?
I'd prefer that the safety experts respond to that question.
That'd be Mr. Thomas?
That'd be Mr. Thomas. Yes.
Okay. All right.
think that's all I have. Thank you, sir.
Other intervener, cross-examination of Mr. Ellis.
Yes, Mr. Ellis, Kurt Holm. On page 3 of your testimony, the top of the page, the middle of the paragraph, which tentatively conclude that the Keystone Project would result in limited adverse environmental impacts both during construction and operation and would be an environmentally acceptable action. Are you speaking there of the construction of the project, the operation, and what about a likely spill in the areas that you saw being crossed environmentally?
I object. That's a compound question.
Why don't you split it up?
I'll split it up. Your explanation there, what do you mean by those three lines in terms from, you're the environmental expert, correct, for this project?
Well, I have a certain set of responsibilities about certain things, yes.
Okay. And so in terms of construction and operation, you were looking at when you walked the site and examined the site, whatever you did in terms of reviewing documents, you were looking to the impacts this would have on the environment. Is that correct?
That's true.
And when we say environment, it's the environment is what?
Well, I mean, from my perspective, it's the environment as it pertains to the areas that I'm testifying to today, which are listed in the front here.
Could you relist them now?
Yes,
specifically?
Glad to. Well, again, this is under on page 2. I was responsible for, and again, some of this is for by compilation. This is information that came from other folks who came from other members of our team who put these sections together, but specifically the environmental 5.1 environmental information file of the Department of State, 5.2 the summary of environmental impacts, 5.3 physical environment, 5.5 terrestrial ecosystems, 5.6 aquatic ecosystems, 5.7 land use and local controls, except for local land use controls, 5.9 air quality, 6.2.6 cultural and historical resources, 6.4.3 noise impacts, and 6.4.4 visual impacts.
So to summarize, it would be people, wildlife, and natural resources. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I mean, summary? I think people to the extent that, that we're looking at noise and visual impacts and, the cultural and historical resources that people, care about.
Okay, on page 4, item 12, in your answer, in the first line of the answer, you state that the pipeline will cross terrain of a low relief and elevation changes of 150 feet or less. And what do you mean by that? The lay of the land is not that rolling or it's flat, or what does that statement say?
Well, it's primarily flat, but the changes in elevation are relatively small.
Now, the route of this pipeline is running along the east side of the James River Basin. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what's immediately to the east, let's say in Marshall County, what's immediately to the east of where the pipeline is routed? Is there any major geological formation?
Well, I'm not sure. Well, exactly which
let me
read. The Katota Prairies is there.
Sure.
There's a big drumlin there.
What is the elevation change? I'm sorry.
I think it was a drumlin.
Mr. Ellis, when you looked at the route and when you looked at your environmental assessment, did you take into account the elevation difference between the Coteau and where the pipeline route was?
Could you restate that question, please?
When you looked at the impacts that the project might have on the area, did you compare the elevation between where the pipe route goes through all the counties and the elevation of the coteau to the east in relation to runoff, spring runoff, snow melt, that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, it was a feature that we considered, but it was primarily because if we're talking about the coteau, it's quite rocky. It has a slope, but again, it was just to the east of where the pipeline was going to run, so there was no benefit in going, you know, up it or near it, or any closer than we needed to.
But in terms of looking at where the pipe went through and crossed a creek or a stream or erodible soils, the drainage basin that goes through that area would have an effect on what might happen to the environment where you cross. Is that correct? Let me just add to that. The elevation of the coteau is about 500 feet higher than where this pipeline is routed, according to U.S. Geological Survey maps. Is that elevation significant in terms of the environmental impact during rainstorms, snow melt?
Well, I think it's fair to say that you would have to consider what sorts of drainages, you know, cross the pipeline and, you know, their size and their incision and that sort of thing. I mean, you would have to ask whether they have to be considered in terms of stabilization of the pipeline right away.
And did you ask those questions and did you look into that issue?
I guess I personally did not, no.
So you would not be able to necessarily say where major drainage ways, what volumes may be coming out of that watershed based on your study?
To my knowledge, we have not. There are not studies done on, like, it sounds like what you're saying is were there stormwater studies done in those drainages?
By your part of this project?
No, sir.
On the top of page five, you refer, the very top line, you refer to little risk of subsistency from fissures and sinkholes, parenthesis karst. Could you describe a karst for us?
Karst is, again, I think Mr. Koski testified to some of this in terms of subsidence, but I mean, karst tends to be limestone deposits that in which you can get, I guess I'll use the word sinkholes, where you can actually get cavities or openings in the rock that allow a certain amount of subsidence above it or the soil above it. So it's an area of concern in terms of stability.
Would a karst in an area along a pipeline route, would a karst also be an area of concern in the event of an oil spill?
It really depends upon what confining materials are there between where the karst or the geologic bed is versus the surface, and whether there are confining layers of clays and other materials that prevent any kind of downward movement of oil.
If there wasn't clay that would keep the oil away from the karst would allow the oil to go down into the ground greater than it normally would into soil. Isn't that correct?
I think it's very site-specific in terms of, I don't know the answer to that.
On page 6, the very top of your testimony, you refer to gravelly soils where water table is at or near the soil surface. And you mentioned that they occurred predominantly in Marshall and Day counties. Is that correct?
That's what it says.
Um, is that an area where you have an area where you have a lot of wetlands and they're in sandy soils? Is that a concern in terms of the routing of an oil pipeline, both construction and operation?
Well, it's a, you know, I mean, I think it's a concern in terms of planning and response. But again, those are conditions that are, you know, that are, you know, sort of regionally occur in a number, you know, quite over a large area. So it certainly is a consideration, but it's not a primary consideration.
Again, the top of page 6, the second sentence there, the predominant occurrence of soils dominated by wetlands are in Marshall and Day County. You must have encountered a great deal of sandy soil and shallow aquifer in that area. Would that be correct to say? Is that what you're saying?
Well, again, I think what we're, you know, I think this particular section, I guess I'm not in a position to comment on just exactly where, you know, the water, you know, where the water table is and what's contributing to it. I think what we're trying to point out here is just simply that these are where we're seeing, I think we're trying to backing up poorly drained soils formed in glacial till with high clay content support pothole wetlands and wet meadows, and they occupy sandy and gravelly soils where the water table is at or near the surface.
Mr. Ellis.
Yes, sorry.
Can you slow down when you read, please?
Okay.
Sorry. Poorly drained soils formed in glacial till.
With a high clay content. Oh, okay. Let me just start over here. Poorly drained soils formed in glacial till with a high clay content support pothole wetlands and wet meadows. Wetlands also occupy sandy and gravelly soils where the water table is at or near the soil surface.
And the next sentence?
And the predominant occurrences of soils dominated by wetlands are in Marshall and Day counties.
So there is a connection between wetlands and shallow aquifer and the recharging of aquifers in some areas might be more sensitive environmentally than areas that have clay soils.
Correct.
Yes. On page 7 of your testimony, item 18, in the answer about 4 lines down, to mitigate the potential for impacts. When Keystone, is Keystone required to mitigate the impact they cause on the environment when they go through an area with their pipeline?
Well, I think there's, you know, when we say mitigate, I think what we're looking at is a restoration plan that conforms to the requirements of agencies, federal and state agencies. It also, you know, it's plans that conform to the needs of landowners. This is just the way pipelines are, you know, are constructed, and then there's a restoration process that, again, you know, sort of addressing, you know, you're just simply trying to put things back together the way, close to the way they were.
On the bottom of page 7, the last paragraph, first line, says that approximately 752 acres represent potential wetland habitat. I assume that means it's crossed, those acres are crossed. Is that what that means?
I believe it states approximately 752 acres represent potential wildlife habitat.
My question, Mr. Ellis, is the environmental officer on this project, or one of them, is the Fish and Wildlife Service or the Game Fish and Parks going to require mitigation of impacted wetlands as they would on other federal projects with a 6-to-1 ratio of replacement? In your opinion, based on your knowledge?
Based on my knowledge now, I don't think we're looking at that kind of mitigation formula, simply because we're essentially restoring, you're putting a pipeline in, and then the functions of that land above the pipe will be allowed to be restored.
I have just one last question on page 9, third line down. Well, actually, these 3-4 bullets in a row, the bald eagle, the least tern, the Dakota skipper, and the Western Prairie Fringe Orchid. Are these endangered species or protected?
Well, the bald eagle was just recently delisted. The least tern and piping plover are listed threatened species. The Dakota skipper butterfly is a federal candidate species. The Western Prairie Fringed Orchid is a federal threatened species, I believe.
Are they protected under the HCA, the highly consequential area, or sensitive areas?
Not explicitly. They are simply based on what their life, you know, where they occur and what they and what their life requirements are is the focus of protection.
Thank you.
Do any other interveners have cross-examination, Mr. Ellis? Ms. Anderson.
Okay. I have just a question. You've got bald eagle winter roost surveys. What's that mean?
Oh, that means we were looking for where the bald eagles aggregate, usually where they roost in trees along the larger rivers, and in some cases some of the smaller rivers, depending on where the food sources are.
So it only matters where they roost in the wintertime?
Sorry?
It only matters where they roost in the wintertime?
Well, I mean, it also matters where they nest in the summertime.
Okay. It says no roosts were observed in South Dakota within 1 mile of the pipeline. 5 miles north of Highway 10 on 415th Avenue and a little over half a mile to the east until apparently this was taken. There has been a bald eagle's nest there. It's not there now.
I object. The intervener's testifying. There's no question.
I'm just asking. I want to know what he's... There, this thing says winter roost survey.
Well, I mean, it was very specifically for winter roost areas, which are where bald eagles aggregate as groups usually.
So my question is, it doesn't matter if it's summer roosting?
Not in this, not as it related to this survey.
May I ask why?
In part we were looking primarily where bald eagles might be affected by the project, and from what we could determine from speaking with the agency, the wildlife agency folks, the main area of concern were the winter roosts. So that was where the primary focus of our work was.
Okay. So then summer does not matter.
Asked and answered.
Thank you.
Sustained. Any other interveners wish to cross-examine? Staff, do you have questions of Mr. Ellis?
No, thank you.
Commissioners, do you want to proceed now, or do you want to, with your questions, or do you want to give the reporter a break first?
I've got a couple. Seems like Commissioner Kolbeck's got a couple. It's not more than that for me, but I would...
Why don't we go ahead and then that'll be a logical breaking point. Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Ellis, I guess the grassland, we were discussing grasslands. All of the grasslands are identified, correct, regardless of ownership, whether it be on federal land, private land, all grasslands were identified.
Yes, that was what we tried to do, was identify. Well, again, it depends on your definition of grasslands, but that was sure. What we were one of our requirements to do as part of your process was to identify the grasslands.
Well, it was required of you. You identified all of them, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And in the hydrotesting the hydrostatic testing, we touched on that. That was another. Is that done by segment? You kind of insinuated it was done by segment. I was curious, is that done by the full 1,300 miles, or is it done by pipe?
Well, it's done in shorter segments, depending on the availability of water, but you can pressurize short segments, test it, move the water along, test another segment, so you can use the same water over again.
Okay.
And if it's important, you can bring the water back and put it back in the watershed that it originated from.
And how is that done, through the pipes, or is
through
it? It's actually tested before the pipe is completed.
No, the pipe is completed. Again, it's part of the sort of the commissioning process for the pipeline.
Sure.
And you're really what you're doing is you're putting a pressure test on your line, mm-hmm. and that's all done before it can be filled with oil. So that whole process goes on just as before the pipeline starts to fill with oil.
And just my last question was just how close is the closest house? But I think Mr. Rasmussen had already asked that. Is there someone, could you refer us to someone who would know that, the answer to that question?
I don't know. I think I would probably... I would probably defer it to Buster. I don't know exactly right now who is the best one to answer that question, but we'll take it under advisement and try to get you an answer.
The requirement that you're required is 50 feet, though, correct?
Well, again, this is sort of, is it a safety, what's the safety standard?
Sure.
I mean, that's, again, I think you can, some of the safety folks can give you a more direct answer, but I think that falls in the area of being reasonable, yes.
All right. That's it. Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Ellis, my question has to do with your testimony, your response to question number 28. That's on page 15, the last paragraph of that answer. You talk about the 2007 field survey reports. Have those reports been completed?
There are field survey reports that have been completed. And they have been filed with the State Historic Preservation Office here in North Dakota, as well as, the Department of State.
Were any route changes or other material changes made to the pipeline route or construction plan as a result of those field surveys?
Yes, I believe one of the realignments that were presented here were in response to a cultural site that was found, and therefore it's been deviated away from that site.
So not all of the field survey reports have been completed, though?
There are still some field work going on that will probably be reported on going into early next year. We've been filing reports incrementally as work is completed, then it's submitted, and then more work is done depending on what needs to be done.
Okay, thanks. That's all I have, Mr. Smith.
Thank you. I had one question, if I might, Mr. Ellis, for you. On paragraph 13, page 5, you state that TransCanada will not attempt to recover study fossils inadvertently discovered. Would you please elaborate on that? I mean, I'm assuming if you come upon a Tyrannosaurus rex, that you will not dig it up and throw it away. Is that?
Well, I think what it says is that we're not. I mean, I think that the project is saying that there's not a specific requirement to locate and preserve fossils that we're aware of.
I've noticed in some of the other and again I'm certainly not an expert. Historical preservation is not something I know much about, but with some of the other projects we've had, there's this whole process with history and all that's culminated in a and I regret to say I can't remember the exact name of the agreement, but there's usually an agreement with the agency that where you agree to undergo a set of steps and procedures if you encounter things that you have not identified prior to the beginning of construction. And do you anticipate that process being followed here?
Well, I think I'm reflecting the sort of the perspective of the project at this point. But, you know, I've heard of what we call them unanticipated find plans, where you encounter things you didn't expect.
But none of the agencies have actually requested that you enter into a memorandum of agreement regarding the dealing with fines like that?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Smith, I have one more question, if that's acceptable
please.
To you.
Oh, yes. Please, you're my boss. Everything's acceptable.
No. I don't want to be out of order, though. On page 16 of your direct testimony, in answer to question 29, you note that the pump station electrical pumps will be long-term noise sources. I'm trying to remember if in the application there was information on how loud that would be or what impact that would have on humans or species. Do you know the answer to that?
Well, I think what we've sort of relied on is kind of a standard that's typically used by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is the 55 decibel A-weighted sound level that could be experienced by a resident, you know, in a house at some distance from the from the pipeline or from the above ground facility, being the pump station. And then usually what happens is that there's some kind of, you know, you actually evaluate the amount of noise that you do in fact predict, and then, you know, take mitigation measures if it exceeds that standard. But that's kind of the working standard that I think we have used in other filings and in this process.
Do you happen to know how far away from the pump station that 55 decibel level must be met at?
Again, it depends on terrain. It depends on the equipment, and we don't have all the specifications on the equipment. So that is not yet a resolved. I can't answer your question.
Okay.
Specifically.
Thank you.
Further commissioner questions? Commissioner Kolbeck.
Sorry, Sherry, this is the last one. I forgot to ask this. To what the extent of the relationship with these government agencies continue through the construction phase? Are they on site every day, or are you have a contact person with these agencies? It's not just once this survey is done, the relationship is over. Is that correct?
Well, I can't really directly answer your question. I mean, typically we get the permits, we fulfill the requirements of the permit.
Sure.
But the specific process by which, you know, the agencies are kept in the loop is defined by, you know, the individual agencies as well as the lead federal agency.
Okay. Thank you.
Other commissioner questions? Do you have any redirect, Mr. Kennedy?
I do when it's fairly substantial, I'd say.
Okay. Well, then we'll take a break. How long a break would you like, Sherry? An hour? No. 10 minutes, say? What do you think, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, that'd be fine. That would be 3:40.
3:40, that's 15 minutes.
Oh, 3:35. You're right.
Want to do that? Yeah, we'll say 10 minutes, and that usually ends up being 15, so we'll set it for 3:40. 3:35. In the record, the hearing is reconvened following about a 10-minute recess. Before we go to your redirect, Mr. Kennedy, there's a housekeeping matter I'd like to bring up. If you recall in the scheduling orders that have been sent out, we referenced tomorrow's hearing convening immediately following the commission meeting, which was scheduled to commence at originally at 9:30, and then it was going to be moved to 8:30. There will not be a commission meeting tomorrow. The items that we had planned to hear tomorrow have not ripened sufficiently to hear, and so we canceled it. A bottom line is, I think what we would like to do, if it's okay with everybody, is commence tomorrow at 8:30, which is the day we're going to commence on all other days, or the time we're going to commence on all other days. You know, we've got a lot of ground to cover here, and I think if we do that, we have stand a real good chance of staying on the schedule that we've sort of laid out. So I give everybody in the room an opportunity, if you like, to comment or object to that, but I think that's what we prefer to do. Any problem with that from anybody? Mm-hmm. Commissioner Hansen?
9 o'clock would have fared much better.
It would? Well, that's fine. No, you're whatever time you want. Okay, Commissioner Hansen had a conflict, and he has requested that we start at 9 o'clock. So we'll start at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Comments?
None. That's acceptable to the applicant. Thank you, Mr. Smith and Commissioners.
Okay, please proceed then, Mr. Kennecke, with your redirect.
Thank you. Mr. Ellis, do you recall before the break when you were asked about unanticipated discovery plans in South Dakota?
Yes.
Are you aware, or is there in fact an unanticipated discovery plan being prepared or have been prepared for South Dakota?
There is, you know, one under preparation for cultural resources in South Dakota.
And if I recall correctly, your testimony before the break was that there was not an unanticipated discovery plan. Is that correct?
There's not an anticipated discovery plan for paleontological resources. So I think if there was any confusion there, then I'd like to clear that up.
And so who is currently considering this cultural unanticipated discovery plan?
The Department of State and the Advisory Council.
Is there any state agency currently, a state of South Dakota agency currently considering the plan that you've discussed?
Yes, the state Historic Preservation Office has also been reviewing this plan.
Is there any timeline for a final word or preparation of that plan that you're aware of?
I don't know when it'll be out.
Very good. Thank you. Do you recall your prior testimony regarding perennial streams?
Yes.
Are there any sources or references of which you're aware that determine or delineate or describe streams as perennial?
Yes. We have the U.S. Geological Survey maps, which make a separation between the intermittent and the perennial streams, which is a good basis on which to start, combined with looking at other things like watershed size.
Did you utilize those maps at all in the preparation of anything you've prepared for the Keystone Project?
Yes. I mean, we used maps of all different sorts, but you know, we did definitely use the USGS databases to define streams.
Do you recall your testimony about the cultural survey work that's been planned and completed in South Dakota?
Yes.
Was that cultural survey work done in accordance with the research design?
Yes, it was.
And was that research design approved by any particular agency, federal or state, to your knowledge?
It was approved by the State Historic Preservation Office in South Dakota.
Thank you very much. I have nothing further.
Any follow-up cross-examination? Mr. Holmes?
Mr. Ellis, you mentioned that water to hydro test the pipe would be found, there'd be attempts to find it along the route of the pipe, either wells or streams. Is that correct?
Yes, I offered those as options.
Did you see any creeks or streams in the northern part of South Dakota where there would be that volume of water on a constant basis to fill a pipe?
I'm not making the appraisal for how much water is available. I think that's probably better left to Mr. Gray, but again, that's, you know, the reliability of the water supply and its size is certainly important factors to consider.
The one reach in the area that I'm most familiar with, the reach of this pipeline is about 40 miles between two pump stations. Based on the size of the pipe, that would be about 13 million gallons of water. That's a lot of water. When the water moves through the pipe, regardless of where you find it, when you move it through the pipe and then you get ready to discharge, what will there be, fines or oils or welding materials that will be in that water or likely to be in that water?
Well, I think, and again, I think Mr. Gray can comment more directly, but I, you know, in my experience, you know, you have to, when you discharge the water, it's subject to a discharge permit, which requires consideration of any contaminants that might be in that pipe.
To your knowledge, at this point, has the project secured a permit from the Department of Environment and Natural Resources to discharge this water?
Not to date that I'm aware of.
Do you know, have they filed for one?
I don't believe they've filed yet.
And then if the pipe, the waters are found, wherever they're found in that quantity, wells or creeks, it's going to be flowing south to Yankton. How do you determine what the point of discharge will be? Will it go in the Missouri River?
I object. We're way outside the scope of the redirect at this point. And the witness has testified several times that another witness is more logical for this line of questioning.
I'm going to sustain that.
Thank you.
Staff? You're excused, Mr. Ellis. Thank you very much.
We'll call Buster Gray to the stand.
Mr. Gray, would you state your name and business address for the record, please?
My name is Lois A., nicknamed Buster Gray, and it's 7509 Tiffany Springs, Parkway, Kansas City, Missouri, 65153.
Are you employed in a position with the Keystone Pipeline Project?
Yes, I'm the engineering and construction manager for the U.S. portion of the project.
Did you provide direct testimony and rebuttal testimony in connection with this application in writing?
Yes.
And I believe that's located on an ever-shortening stack of papers to your left, in the middle of the, further to your left. One more up. There you go. Find your testimony on the top of that stack?
I have it.
Is it in two separate exhibits?
Mr. Konecki, there's a bunch of things here. Okay. I'm not sure if I know how to tell if it's two separate exhibits. Yes, I see it now, the TC 5 and 6.
Should be 5D and 5R.
I have 5D and 6.
Yeah, I'll come over there. Hang on.
Okay, this is...
Are those the written testimonies you filed in preparation for this matter today?
Yes.
I see that you're responsible for Section 1.4 of the application, and that's contained in a binder right under your left hand at page 1.
Yes.
Is the project still proposing to commence construction in April of 2008?
Construction right now is proposed from May to the end of May 1st of June this coming year in 2008.
I do have some questions for you, given the proceedings today, in addition to what's in your written testimony, but I'll ask you first, if I was to ask you the questions contained in your written testimony again today, would your answers be the same?
Yes.
Given that, have you had an opportunity to review the rebuttal testimony filed by staff regarding native prairies?
I did review some members of that testimony, and I do believe, I can't remember if it's Mr. Jansen or Mr. Mulhausen, but one of those gentlemen.
And I believe also Exhibit B, which has been introduced, the construction mitigation reclamation plan, should be in front of you there. Is Native Prairie addressed within that document?
It's not addressed specifically in it as Native Prairie. We talk about pasture and rangeland or grasslands in that document.
What do you know if Keystone is planning to take any steps to reclaim native prairies?
Is the mitigations that are outlined, I'd have to go specifically to the document in it, but indeed, you know, that we strip topsoil or strip the vegetation. We reclaim, trying to use native seed mixes, those types of mitigations are utilized.
Is one of the requests for a condition from staff the proposal to construct the pipeline in areas of native prairie only in the fall?
That was one of the recommendations in some of the testimony of staff.
Did you hear the prior testimony that of Mr. Ellis, that we're dealing with approximately 3 miles of native grasslands along the pipeline route?
I don't recollect the specific miles, but I recollect the testimony.
Is it practical to construct those 3 miles, wherever they might be, of pipeline construction only in the fall, given the pipeline construction season, the number of spreads you're proposing?
No, in looking at that requirement with my staff in Kansas City, I actually have a table and I don't have it with me, but the 3 miles are made up of, I believe, some in excess of 30 or 40 locations. They're not contiguous necessarily. And for pipeline construction, we construct in an assembly line fashion of the various crews. I think that I discussed back when I made presentations back in the summer. But the continuity of that construction and the interruption that would be caused by moving around or skipping those tracks would be a significant impact to the construction of the project.
In your experience, I guess I should ask you, it's in your direct testimony, but you do have substantial experience in pipeline construction.
I'm entering my 30th year of this type of work.
Are you aware of any place else where you've been, or do you recall any place else in any pipeline project you've been on in 30 years, anywhere where grasslands could only be constructed in the fall?
I've never had a condition or a mitigation like that on a project I've been involved in.
Are you also aware of a request cover open-bodied trucks during construction?
Yes. Again, that was in staff's testimony or rebuttal testimony, one of the two.
Would it be your position then that the covering of open-bodied trucks containing sand and soil on paved roads would be acceptable?
That would be acceptable, and I believe in my, I don't know if mine's rebuttal or sir rebuttal or which one it is, but indeed I do not think it is on rural or unpaved roads. I don't believe it's a reasonable request.
What kind of open-bodied trucks will be used in the construction process?
Well, I think the reference is this is more like a dump truck that would be hauling truly large volumes of sand or dirt or various things. That we have a lot of pickup trucks, we have a lot of open body low boy that we move heavy equipment with and things, and there's no practicality to trying to cover those types of trailers.
Do you recall the request for condition regarding maintaining a 75-foot right-of-way in wetlands?
Yes, I recollect that as well.
And what would be your position with respect to that request?
Well, a couple of comments to it are is that the federal guidelines that seem to be the mechanism that the industry has followed over the past 16 or 17 years, it established a 75-foot criteria, but it has no relationship to diameter of pipeline. It has no relationship to depth of pipeline. And experience on projects has shown for large diameter pipelines with the amount of materials we have to excavate that it's extremely difficult to keep all the spoils in 75 feet. On our project, we're actually adding another foot depth of cover to 4 feet, where most pipelines are constructed with 3 feet, which creates more spoil materials as well. And as we laid out our mitigation plan and things, we laid out an 85 feet width, just so that we didn't have the constraints, particularly in non-cohesive soils, with additional width.
So I'm not sure if I understand. Are you willing to maintain a 75-foot right-of-way in wetlands where there's non-cohesive soils?
We are not willing to do it in non-cohesive soils, only in cohesive soils, and that we believe we can meet that condition reasonably, but non-cohesive soils, we don't believe we can meet it at all.
Do you recall the request regarding the topsoil stripping and the notion that we would strip the trench and the spoil side in the SIR rebuttal testimony from the staff?
I do.
And what's your position with respect to that request?
It's from my experience over the years is that in agricultural lands, and particularly with landowners, it's been my experience that they understand their land and their topsoil better than anybody does. And I believe in our easement acquisition process, we have a mechanism by which the landowner can pick or choose one of three methods, being our default method being the trench line only. I believe the SIR rebuttal testimony is recommending that the default be the trench and spoil side as we describe it. And from a personal basis, the three methods are trench line is the minimal disturbance, trench and spoil is the second, and full right-of-way is the third. It's my personal opinion we ought to let the landowner decide which of those three disturbances he would prefer to have rather than the default being the middle one.
You recall Mr. Ellis's testimony regarding permitting for surface water use and discharge and hydro testing?
Yes.
Have you or anybody under your command or control applied for permits for either use of water or discharge of it?
Those permits have been under preparation and are almost finalized to be submitted for as permit applications probably near the end of the year, here around the 1st of January.
And when did those requirements for permitting come to your attention?
The requirements for permitting have been known a long time. It's just we as we move along in design and various things, as we get further in the, I guess, in the process of design to where we know how we want to segment the pipeline for testing, we're typically doing sources and discharge locations. And as we get more knowledge, but typically once we get a permit application together, submit it 3 to 6 months to receive an approval is pretty standard.
Do you anticipate any difficulties in receiving those permits from the South Dakota Department of Environment and Natural Resources?
I do not.
Are they commonly obtained elsewhere?
Yes, they're very commonly obtained.
You've been referred to previously as one of the expert witnesses with regard to routing and route changes of the pipeline. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe the prior witnesses in deferring to me is that the route change process that we implement, I'm ultimately the person that makes the recommendation to TransCanada of making a route change or not.
Are you familiar with any route changes or the route through the city of Yankton, South Dakota?
I am.
Have you or someone under your command or control been dealing with the city of Yankton or any officials of the city?
One of the engineers on my staff has been meeting with the city. I will tell you we've met for over 18 months now at various points in time discussing the city's intention, I guess an industrial park or something to the north and kind of more to the east than to the north of the city, and trying to route our pipeline to minimize impact to that proposed development.
And have you been able to meet their requests?
When I say to our knowledge we have, we've made one recent adjustment that we still need to go back and meet with the city on, and it's been discussed in this hearing, the rerouting by the particular hotels. We've not gotten complete confirmation from the city on that without going back to meet with them.
If you'll give me just a minute, please. Mr. Gray, are you familiar with what we call Data Request 1-10?
I believe I am. That's the one that's related to the construction cost or labor or something of that nature.
I will tell you it's been admitted as evidence, and then I will ask you, are you the witness to whom people should address questions regarding that?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I have nothing further. Thank you.
Mr. Rasmussen, you ready? Please proceed.
Mr. Gray, I would like to ask you about the rerouting or at least some of the rerouting that's been done, and I think that's represented in Exhibits 9 and 10, which, I don't know, would they still be at the table there, or?
I'm sorry, I'm at your disadvantage. I was gathering my papers. What was your question?
Where are Exhibits 9 and 10?
I'll find them.
Okay.
Thank you.
Which one's 9?
9 is the one with the multiple page document. Yeah. Let's start with that
one. Okay. All right.
Are you familiar with each of these route changes that are referenced in those documents that are part of Exhibit 9?
When I say I'm familiar with them is if we've done a multitude of these over the course of the project across all states over the past year and a half, and the recollection of the specifics of each one, I may need a little refresher, true, and something that would be helpful to me is there was a table that was submitted that might help refresh my memory.
That's what you're talking about?
Yes.
I think Brett will give that to you.
I have it now.
Okay. I'm not going to ask you about each one of these, but I did have questions about a few of them. Looking, and we'll just refer to the table. I think that makes it easier. The second one on the table, reroute to avoid NRCS easement. Do you recall what that was about?
I do recall that the NRCS had I'm trying to say 3 or 4 tracts of land across the 1,000 miles of project that they requested us consider a reroute to avoid their easements on 3 or 4 tracts of land, and I believe this was one of those.
Just so the record is clear, what is the NRCS?
National Resource Conservation Service, I believe.
And what sort of, do you remember what sort of land that we're talking about here on this particular reroute?
I do not particularly remember, no.
It was in Marshall County, though, I take it. Is that right? If you look at the actual map that corresponds, it would be the second page of Exhibit 9. It indicates at the bottom that it's Marshall County, does it not?
Thank you, yes.
The next one would be the next one down. It's a Hutterite request to move the alignment 500 feet to the east. Do you remember why they asked for that reroute?
Yes, I do, and I don't remember which particular colony this was, but they have a complex of buildings and homes and their farming operations at this particular location, and it indicated a future plan to expand those operations in the direction of the pipeline with building some new buildings. I can't remember what the buildings were for, but they requested that we relocate the pipeline relative to that future development, and we acknowledged it and did that.
The next one is references a landowner request to offset the alignment east of a residence. I guess it moved it from 394 feet to 666 feet away from a Phyllis Tisher residence. Is that right?
That's correct.
And do you remember what the reason for that request was, just to get it farther away from their residence?
As I recollect, that was it. And there may be some other family involved in this one, a brother or a son or something, that may have a few other connotations besides just the residence, but I don't remember the details of it.
But as originally designed, it would have run within 500 feet of the residence, but it was moved outside of that 500-foot area, correct?
That's correct.
Is there a minimum distance that you have to be away from a residence?
There's not by our codes or regulations or federal regulations. There's a 50-foot requirement in those regulations that if you're closer than 50 feet, you have to have additional depth of cover which by us being the 4 feet, we comply with that. The industry, there's an API recommended practice. It's not a code per se, but a recommended practice that recommends a 50-foot minimum distance. And then lastly, our easement instrument where we acquire rights from the landowner is we have a 50-foot easement, and just in this example, if the pipeline's in the center of the easement, we have restrictions about the ability to build structures on that 50 feet of easement.
There was some earlier testimony about there being 18 residences. I think it was within 500 feet. Do you remember? Or maybe it was, I think it was 500 feet.
I recollect that testimony.
Do you know what the closest of those residences is to the pipeline?
You know, I was asked that in the break, and I'm relatively comfortable with saying a couple of hundred feet. I could certainly verify that. The closest structure to us, to my knowledge right now, is Mr. Hone asked questions about the particular hotels. Actually, with that reroute, I believe those would be the closest ones. And I would have to go back, but I think 100 feet or so is that distance. I would have to confirm those.
The hotels are about 100 distance.
That's correct. The structures. I don't know if it's the living quarters or what the structures are.
Would that be 100 feet from both of the hotels, kind of split them down the middle?
That's my understanding.
Okay. But you said that reroute isn't set in stone yet. That's still subject to negotiation or discussions with Yankton?
It's not only the city of the Yankton, but the affected landowners as well.
All right. Then on this summary sheet, the next one, it says unsigned landowners Wagner, Townsend, Anderson requested reroute to minimize possible impacts to land. Well, when you say unsigned landowners, does that mean landowners that haven't signed an easement?
That's correct.
And did they sign an easement after the reroute?
This group of landowners did, yes.
And do you remember what impact that they were concerned about, that they wanted the pipeline moved?
They were concerned relative to the Mr. Wagner had approached us with this particular request concerning his description of being some of the most prime or valuable farmland in the particular county. I don't know if this is Day or Marshall, but he had approached us in this particular location. We are traversing kind of northeasterly to southwesterly, so we're cutting across tracts of lands in an angular fashion, and this request was made to us to adjust our route to where we weren't going through some of the prime tracts of land as he described it that angular fashion.
What sort of criteria do you use in deciding whether you will agree to a request like that from a landowner that they would like it rerouted somewhat?
Is we have a process by which we engage the various disciplines or expertises involved in the project. And when I say that, there's environmental, there's of course land and right-of-way itself. There's engineering, there's construction. Those things, those inputs are gathered through a process that we have. Costs are taken into consideration as well, and even things like public consultation or other things that might be affected by the project. All that information is gathered, and my engineers bring a recommendation to me to review and approve. Once I have all that information, I guess I somewhat serve as judge and jury about the process and determine whether or not the reroute should be moved forward with or not. Although once I do approve it, TransCanada, it's forwarded to TransCanada for final approval.
Have they followed your recommendation in all cases, or have they?
I would tell you in 90 to 95%, there's been a few that they've rejected that I've fired. And I can't remember particularly the reasons, but there's been a few.
Have there been a number of landowner requests that have been denied for one reason or another?
There have been a number through the project that have been denied. It would be hard for me to quantify in it, but I would tell you probably as many or more have been denied as have been accepted.
I'm sorry, more have been denied? Is that what you said?
I would say as many, if not more.
Oh, okay.
Yes, sir.
All right. Going down this list, Brett, do you have any objection? We just mark this as an exhibit since we've been referring to it.
No, none.
Go ahead and have her mark it.
Mr. Gray, I just now mark that summary sheet that we've been talking about as Web Exhibit 1, and I've got the originals since I'm referring to it, but that's the summary of the route variations between April 27 and November 20 of 07 that we've been talking about. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. The dates of this document, April 27, 07 through November 20, 07. Following the one about the Wagner, Townsend, et cetera, then we have several reroutes due to the Fish and Wildlife Service wetland easements. I don't think we need to talk about those individually, but reroutes were done because of input from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, correct?
That is correct. Right.
Then we've got the next one we have is a reroute to avoid a cultural site. Is that right?
That's correct.
What was the nature of the cultural site?
I cannot speak for the details of it. It's when we do our cultural resource surveys, when I say if artifacts or things are located, we have some options. One obvious is to further do cultural surveys to try and clear the site or to see if we can make route adjustments to simply avoid it. And we generally balance kind of the cost and impacts and the landowners relative to that. And I would suggest on this one, we determined that an adjustment of the route was the simplest or the easiest thing for us to do.
Do you remember what county that site is in?
I would have to reference the site number and milepost, but I can't. Just looking at this table.
I think the Exhibit 9 would have the map indicating that it's, looks like between mileposts 392 and 393, if I read that correctly. It would be the one that looks like this at the top.
I have it here, and I'm trying to see if it's got the county on there anywhere.
I don't see the county.
I do not. I could determine it by the milepost with a set of maps, but I can't do it sitting here.
Okay. The mileposts refer to the entire length of the pipeline. Is that right?
Zero is at the Canadian border.
Right. Okay. What's the milepost at the South Dakota border? Do you know?
It's 435, 4 something in that range.
At the northern border?
Oh, at the northern.
I'm
217,
okay.
And the southern is 430,
all right,
somewhere in that range.
Thank you.
Mr. Rasmussen, we've got the maps up there. He could answer your question if you let him take a look, if you want.
Yeah, I guess I would like to know if that's available.
The exhibit, this book. It appears to be right. Of course, the county names aren't on here, but the there's Yankton County. I would know it by name, and then the second it would be the third county up from Yankton.
Okay. Well, we can figure that out there. All right. Thank you. Going back to exhibit, to web exhibit one, then the next one is indicates that landowner indicated they would sign easement agreement if line was moved west adjacent to right of way or road right of way. And that's the landowner must be named Schultz. Is that right?
That would be my belief.
Okay. Have you? And I know you told me we had a similar situation with the Wagners and the Townsends that they. They agreed to sign the easement after you moved the pipeline. Have you had that situation come up frequently?
We've had it come up some. I would tell you, in the areas we're acquiring right away, maybe we're acquiring in North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Illinois at this time. And I would say in those states, I'd say 20 or 30 times.
That you've moved the pipeline in order to get the landowner to sign the easement?
No, I misunderstood your question. I thought the number of times it's been requested.
You're right. That may have been what I said. Okay. How many times has it been moved?
I would say less than five.
Right. And would the two that we just, the Wagner one and the Schultz one, would those have been the only ones in South Dakota that you're aware of where it's?
Yes. And I can't remember. I do think there is one reroute that has occurred since November the 20th. I cannot recollect the details of it right now. I do not know if it is related to this topic or your question, though.
Okay, the next one then is that it indicates it was rerouted because a landowner had plans for an equestrian facility. In the future, is that right?
That's correct.
And then similar, the next one, the landowner was going to have a future feedlot site, and so you moved it in that occasion too.
That's correct.
The second to the last one indicates the route was adjusted to shorten the length and to remove three bends. Removing bends, is that something that you like to do?
As I remember, and I may need to refer to one moment, please.
Sure.
This is just to the north of Yankton, and if my memory serves me, I'm looking at this aerial photograph. But if my memory serves me, it's just north of Yankton. I don't know if in our left's the airport, but I believe originally a landowner had reflected to us that they would prefer us do the red line that had the bends, and in further conversations they were fine with the yellow route that was shown, and it simply makes the route shorter. Bends just create some additional wells for us, and we'd like to remove them.
Do bends create additional concerns about possible leaks? Is a leak more likely to occur at a bend than at a straight area?
I would suggest to you no. And it's made of compatible and comparable materials as the mainline pipeline is.
Okay. Then the last one on this exhibit one is a realignment so as not to encroach on a Kanab pipeline. And that's within the city of Yankton or right near the city of Yankton, is that right?
That's correct.
What would have been the concern about being, well, when it says encroach, I guess what does that mean? Does that mean it was close to it or?
As my understanding was, there were two issues here. It's one, the existing Canal pipeline, but there's a large tower with guy wires that extend from that you see in the left hand, the little white dots or square there in the guy wires, and we were between the guy wires and the tower and did not realize we were there. and we were asked to move out from under that guy wire, and we did as such. The encroachment with Kanab, honestly can't answer the question. I don't remember that as being the issue. I thought the issue was indeed moving away from the guy wire.
The Kanab pipeline isn't shown on the aerial photograph, is it?
It is not, to my knowledge, no. I don't see it.
Okay, then why don't you turn to Exhibit 10, and that we don't have a summary sheet for those. Those are just the two-page exhibit. The second page is the hotel situation we've already talked about. The first page, do you know, that's a Marshall County reroute. Do you know the specifics of that one?
And I do believe these may be the two I've referenced that have came up since November 20th. I'm not certain.
That's my understanding. These are the more recent ones.
And the particular landowner's name on Exhibit 10, the first page that you see the very wet area where the pipeline was rooted in red around it is... So I don't know the best way to say this, but the farmer has drained all of that, and he has dried it out. And my understanding from the request was that he has drained that. It's no longer wet, and he's going to be farming it. And he made the request that we go straight versus what we had.
Do you anticipate any additional changes? Well, I guess you've already talked a little bit about Yankton. There might be some additional change there. Other than through the city of Yankton, do you anticipate any additional changes to the route?
It's certainly, my experience would tell you yes, in that any time you move from kind of the initial routing phase into the easement acquisition phase, particularly in meeting with landowners, you get feedback to issues that you just don't learn about until you're in kind of more of an intimate setting of negotiation with them, whether it's issues like we discussed on this list. But I would tell you that I think at this stage of the project they will be minimal, but to say there would be none, I don't know that we've uncovered absolutely every landowner's issue.
In constructing the pipeline, you will cross a number of rural water pipelines. You're aware of that?
That's correct.
Are there any special precautions that are taken or do you plan to take when crossing the water pipelines?
It's relative to whether it's water pipelines or other utilities. We will typically communicate with those companies or organizations to determine any special things relative to their utilities. But I would tell you normally, other than construction methods, how we excavate, how we support, how we do things, as far as a design perspective, other than meeting our code requirements, no.
You don't negotiate separate agreements with the other utilities you pass to ensure that those utilities are okay with your construction methods, that sort of thing?
When I say the interface and the meeting with those utilities is, I'm trying to determine if the word negotiate is the proper term that I would say. We certainly any linear facility like this, we intersect other utilities and highways and railroads, and we have to deal with those particular entities. My experience has been is that other utilities that have an easement similar to what we have, which I call a non-exclusive easement, because it doesn't have specific things in it that preclude. The landowner still has the ultimate rights, and that's who we buy the land from. But we typically will meet with those organizations. The industry has a practice of we will enter a voluntary agreement with other utilities as long as the requirements put forth by those utilities are reasonable.
There's been testimony about the thickness of the pipe being increased when you go under a roadway. Are you familiar with that?
I am.
Okay. And is that done under every roadway that the thicker pipe would be used?
I would tell you there's a distinguishment between public and private roads.
Under every public roadway?
Typically, although I would tell you it varies by state and region, for an oil pipeline, which is a liquid pipeline, is our federal codes do not require different design factors which relate to different wall thicknesses. Typically, what we run into in a lot of states and counties is it's a local requirement, not a federal requirement.
Well, what is the plan for South Dakota?
The plan in South Dakota, the project, and across the entire route is to put heavier wall pipe at public road crossings.
I believe it's, I represent a rural pipeline, and I believe virtually all of our pipe runs right next to the roadway, or close to the roadway anyway. Would there be any reason that the wall thickness couldn't be extended a little farther so that it would be thicker as it went over or above the rural water lines?
I think with relative to the question is that it would be a function of distance for me. If it's a few feet from the road right-of-way line, it's facilitated. But if it's a substantial distance, then I'm not certain that it would be warranted.
What would be
or not warranted, but would be practical. I'm sorry.
What would be your definition of a substantial distance?
I think probably anything greater than 5 or 10 feet.
There's been testimony here today about hydrostatic testing, and everybody says you're the guy to talk to about that. So, tell me how that works, or what the plan is for the hydrostatic testing of the pipe that would run through South Dakota.
We typically segment the pipeline into about 20 or 30 mile sections, relative to the length that we'll test at one particular time. Sometimes you might get 40, and at worst case, maybe 50 miles in it. But there are a variety of things that make you break up your test. Some of its elevation is because of the hydrostatic head of the water. It adds pressure into the test that gives you limits as to what you can length of test. And then things like where one contractor starts, another one stops, pump stations, other things in it. But with that in mind, I would have to go back and I don't know that it's been filed anything to see, but at this time we do have a preliminary test plan across the state of South Dakota that has the various test sections and the water sources and discharge locations spelled out. And that will be submitted in various permit applications, but it has not been submitted today, but I would suggest to you within the month it would be.
And who will that be submitted to?
It's generally an attachment to a number of applications. When I say the Corps of Engineers, which the 401 certifications, which are part of the state processes. But it's not, you don't seek a particular permit for the test plan itself. It's an attachment to other permits.
There's been reference to a discharge permit. I assume it would be attached to that.
That's right. There are discharge permits and I guess NPDES permits and things like that it's attached to.
What will be the source of the water that's used for the hydrostatic testing?
Again, without it in front of me, it's some of the larger streams that we cross in South Dakota. I mean, a James River, probably the Missouri River, those that have a significant supply of water at the time that we would be constructing that would have the volumes needed to fill our pipeline.
Is the water then returned to that particular stream when
you're done using it?
We have sought in our permits to return it to the watershed of the stream, but my experience in the past 10 years is it's typically mandated that we return it to the same stream that it came out of.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Mr. Hone, do you have questions of the witness?
Yes, please. Mr. Gray, in terms of your project, the way you construct your project and design the project, will the Keystone Pipeline come in contact with ductile iron water lines on any of the 8 rural water systems you'll be crossing?
Is when I'm and I'm trying to say I don't know that I know the answer to the questions. We have sent correspondence to all the rural water companies, and 2 or 3 have responded to us, and some have not. Particularly, we requested size, type, being cast iron or plastic, and that information. But I can't tell you that I've reviewed them today. My guess would be yes, though.
And if there is, in fact, pipe that you either cross with this pipeline, a ductile iron water line that serves a rural water system, they have cathodic protection in that pipeline. Your system will have cathodic protection. What precautions do you take to assure that neither pipe damages the other pipe?
And I'm not going to profess to be a cathodic protection expert, but when we cross other metallic utilities, be it another pipeline, which we cross ours, we'll typically work with that company to bond a wire onto their system and onto our system and put a cathodic test station at that location where we can check for interference.
That is a very sensitive issue for your pipeline and possibly for a water line, because stray current can affect either, can it?
Stray current can affect either, but we cross thousands of other pipelines and utilities. It's a very manageable interface.
Thank you. The next question regarding the routing. Your pipe tends to, more than, say, water lines, rural water lines, your pipe tends to cut across quarter sections, cut across the center of property maybe, or the center of a section, whereas rural water tends to follow the section lines. Is there a reason that the pipe is not routed along a section line for maintenance and for accessibility?
No, I would tell you that, of course, when you look in a micro scale, but I mean, we are in essence trying to go from point A to point B as efficiently as we can go, because it takes energy to pump product down the pipeline in it, our desire to try and go as expediently as we can, and our belief that we can restore the right-of-way to pre-existing conditions. Pipeline industry's had a tendency to route in the most expedient routing it can.
I've attended meetings where you've been present, several meetings where landowners have discussed issues with all pipes, water pipes, oil pipes. Mm. Would it be fair to say that the cutting across a quarter or a section is an issue of concern for most landowners, farmers, because of the sectioning off of the property?
I would tell you that that from a landowner's perspective, I would concur that more landowners are concerned when we are crossing diagonally versus parallel to their property. Even though, as you've heard me at meetings, try and convince landowners that that's not a concern, I would agree that it is.
Well, and the issue that came up at those same meetings, the colony at Britain and the various places, If the question that often comes up, and I'll pose it to you again, and you've heard it from landowners, so this is not a new one, but if a leak occurs in the center of the section or the center of the quarter, the access for your crews to get to it is you have to cross crop to get to it. I mean, that you're not really, in most cases, you're not right along the road. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say.
That's an issue for the landowner because they're concerned about the damage to the crop to get out in the middle of the field where the leak is.
It's certainly a concern. My comment being is we are responsible for the damages that we cause. If we have to access due to the unlikely event of an emergency and destroy crops, we would have to compensate for those damages.
On page 3, if I could refer you to your testimony, I think it's item 12. This is the hydrostatic testing again.
I have that.
Okay. You refer to the hydro testing, this statement refers to the hydro testing as being 125% of maximum pressure, correct?
125% of the maximum operating pressure.
So that would be how much pressure?
Approximately 1,800 pounds.
When you're testing the pipeline, a section of pipeline or a pump station at that pressure, do you evacuate homes that are nearby or property that's occupied and nearby?
We typically do not. We do typically notify landowners that a testing operation will be occurring to make them aware of it, but at the types of distances and setbacks that we have, the 100 or 200 feet, we're not concerned because, one, water's not combustible, and then secondly, because it's not a compressible fluid, it's water that you don't have an explosion or what if you did have a leak or a rupture.
Does a federal regulation that you have to comply with, does it require vacating property when you're testing within 300 feet?
Vacating property,
asking people to leave while you're testing?
I do not believe that it requires you to vacate it.
Okay. The next question is in regarding to discharge of the water you've used to test. You're moving the water from one section to the other, so it's used multiple times. You might pull the water out of the James River at, say, Britain, and then use it all the way to Yankton. Is that what you're saying? Is that an example of what you're saying?
We do transfer water from one test section to another test section. I would have to review this particular test plan, but because, again, of contractor breaks, other topographical features, the transfer of one, say, 30-mile section of water 6 or 8 or 10 times is typically not. I would tell you more of a rule of thumb would be maybe 2 or 3 uses of the same water.
And when you do secure a permit from the state to discharge, generally are you required to put the water into some kind of containment and settlement? There must be a well debris or steel debris or something in the pipe with all those wells. There's a well every 40 feet. Do you do anything in particular to treat the water before it's discharged?
Well, at the start of the filling process, we clean the pipeline. We actually use what we call wash water, and we'll put in, say, I'd have to figure it up in gallons or barrels, but we'll put in several hundred feet of what we call wash water between some cup or cleaning pigs by which we clean any debris out of the pipeline that's been put into it during construction. So in essence, once you have cleaned the pipeline and you put water in it for testing, the majority of this debris that you're describing has already been removed.
Is there anything in the wash water, or is it just water between two styrofoam pigs?
It's wash water between two cup pigs, we call it. I'm in a loss for words. It's just heavy-duty plastic.
Which kind of pushes the sediments or the pieces on down.
That's correct.
On page 9, again, 49, you talk about testing the sections. We're kind of a water-hungry state. A lot of where you're going through, there's not a lot of water in creeks and streams, as the environmental person testified. Have you identified any well sources that you might use in the event that a stream is not available?
We haven't at this time. Is that I, my staff in Kansas City and interfacing with, I don't know if it's DNR here in South Dakota or agencies, we generally get information concerning the flow in streams and the volume available at the times of year that we'll be testing. Many times we may get a permit restriction that limits the rate that we can withdraw the water. We like to withdraw at around 3,000 gallons per minute, but sometimes we may be restricted on what we can withdraw so that we don't cause impact to the stream. But at this time, no one's on my staff has advised me that they don't believe that we will not have adequate water from streams that we cross along the route.
And when you do draw water out of the stream, in terms of getting a discharge from, say, a discharge permit from DNRD, you would probably also have to consult with the Game, Fish, and Parks because of the impact on fisheries? Is that?
Mr. Holland, I might have to defer back to Mr. Ellis or someone more into the details of the permitting. My familiarity is the permits that I mentioned and getting permits to the streams we have, and whether that agency gets input from all the other agencies, I'm not sure exactly how that works.
But at some point, you're going to issue contracts to someone who's building and testing, and you will tell them where you've got permission to draw water. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And that contractor will be instructed. They won't just go out and do it on their own. They'll have direction in the document they bid.
At the time of bid, we typically don't have that information. We give them assumptions about what can be used, but once we receive our permits with the actual locations, we truth our bid document and put that in the actual construction contract that will be executed.
So you would convey to the contractor where and when they could draw and what the permits told them they could do. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say.
On page 2 of your, I guess this would be your rebuttal, page 2.
I have that document.
Okay. 6, item A, your answer to 6, about the third line down, you were responding to compaction caused by construction. This is 6. And then your answer, the second or third line, these include topsoil removal. Do you see?
Yes, I do see that.
You're talking about the contractors went through, built the project, and now there's compaction of what soil, what area?
Okay, is what we call the workspace or where the heavy equipment moves up and down the right-of-way. Is compaction caused by our heavy equipment.
And further on, it talks about what you would do, what TransCanada Keystone would do to get the soil back to sort of the normal state. Is that what it's saying? In other words, how do you do that? How do you get the compacted soil back to sort of a normal?
We decompact with the use of of ripping and tools and power plows and things very similar to what the farmers utilize.
Is that portion of the contract in the construction contract? Does the contractor who built that part of the pipeline have to go back then and do that?
He does. That's correct.
And you have that specifically in the document?
That is correct.
As a requirement. The last sentence then talks about agricultural production. And if the compaction wasn't done just quite properly, you might have a problem. It says Keystone would be liable to work with the landowner to restore the land further. If the contractor did the ripping, as you spelled out in your contract, and left the area, probably moved on down the pipeline, and the next season the landowner contacted your office and said, you know, I'm not happy with what happened, what do you envision the mechanism might be? Does your person go back out and meet with them, and then what happens? If the contractor's out of the area, what happens? Who takes care of it?
Is TransCanada or Keystone, in establishing its operations in the area, one of the departments that it would have for the project, it maintains a land or a right-of-way interface with all landowners along the project. What I would envision here, and granted, I do want to make perfectly clear, I'm not the operations person, but from my experience, is that a landowner would contact Keystone's office, registering a concern about the restoration of the land and the productivity of his crops, and he would either present evidence of such, say, photographs, other things, that he would submit to TransCanada to substantiate his claims, or he may simply request a meeting with a representative on his property to look at the land and the issues that have occurred. And that is a relatively normal process, I would suggest to you, whether it's 1 year after the pipeline's built or 10 years after it's built.
Mr. Gray, you've been in the business a long time. I've not been in that long, but my experience has been, and I'd like to ask you this question, do contractors always do what you tell them in the contract specs?
Yes. Is, you know, the question is you have to say is do contractors comply 100%? Certainly it's our expectation to enforce the contract specs and requirements to the full extent possible or practical, but just as you've described with decompaction, are there potentially places along this 1,000 miles of pipeline that are going to have compaction issues? I would suggest to you they will be. I believe they'll be minimal and localized, and that is why we have these follow-up mechanisms to deal with the process.
Well, I'm leading to this question then. Will your office have, or Keystone have, on-site inspectors that if a landowner felt that the things that you promised when you were up in the area, when you talked to people at public meetings, were not being done the way they thought you or somebody had represented, will there be representatives on-site, inspectors that they could go to and issue, on the job site issue, a question to get enforcement?
Actually, what you've described is that during construction, there'll be probably at the peak of construction, I would say some 25 to 30 inspectors on a construction spread. That's a contractor covering, say, 100 to 130 miles of pipeline. And if you recollect from some of my presentations, the assembly line, these inspectors generally are associated with the various crews, but a couple of things that, and certainly they're looking for quality, but there will be anywhere from 2 to 3 environmental inspectors that their sole responsibility is the environmental permit requirements. Typically embedded within those 2 or 3 inspectors, environmental inspectors are when I say somebody that's very familiar with agriculture, and when we can arrange for it for someone out of this region that's familiar with agriculture in this region. But one of the most difficult tasks I face is the restoration of the land to return it to its original productivity for farming. And to do that, whether it's ripping the land for decompaction and testing it for that decompaction relative to off-site lands, we try to achieve the same level of compaction that's in the adjacent land to the right-of-way, or removal of rock, or various things like that, that there's documentation and inspections done to ensure that those specifications are met to the best of our ability.
I have one last question, and it refers to page 4 of your rebuttal. Page 4, item 10, has to do with township roads. The road system in some of the rural areas ranges somewhere from county blacktop, gravel, to dirt road section lines, and you've probably seen all of that. One of the concerns...
Excuse me, is that a question you want an answer to?
That's a question, yes.
Yes, I've certainly seen the roads in this region of the country.
I guess the question is, when the contractors that are bringing in equipment are bringing in some fairly heavy equipment compared to what we might see in those areas. It's large construction equipment.
You know, Mr. Hone, it's certainly very large equipment that I would say, as far as equipment goes, but then, and I don't mean this to be argumentative, but I mean there's heavy loads moved by farmers with agricultural grain and things as well, and some of that's comparable to us, but we do have some equipment that's large.
And when the pipe gets hauled in, that will be heavy loads on trucks. Would that be correct?
That is correct.
What can you do, or what will you plan? What do you plan to do, I guess, in the documents that would give the farmers and the township officials the assurance that the roads would be maintained while the construction is going on, as well as after they leave? Some of the road, there's always road restrictions in our part of the world in the spring of the year, and the question is, you bid the job. Does your instructions to your contractor also talk about that contractor maintaining these roads?
It speaks in terms of a couple of things, and one is I guess just some background. I constructed a large diameter pipeline across North Dakota in 1999 and 2000. And I'm intimately familiar with township and county roads, particularly high groundwater and heavy equipment, and the damage that can be done to roads in that environment. And we are like so many of our permits, we are in the process of filing all of our road crossing permits with the various counties and townships here over the next month. Typically what that instigates is the very question that you're asking about is you're asking for a permit to cross our road, but we want assurance about damage to our road system besides just where you're going to cross it. And again, in many rural counties in areas that don't have a lot of energy pipelines like we are, they many times don't even know how to deal with us. But typically what we work with them with is whether it's an agreement drafted by the county, an agreement about what our responsibilities for roads. We typically will work with counties about which roads we use, when we use them, kind of a traffic plan to minimize disruption or damage to the roads, because we have to pay to fix them. And so we certainly try and do that coordination, but that is, again, something in our process that just occurs at this point in time. But that is very common that we enter into some type of agreement, and many times people ask me about enforcement to their in it is that the county and townships, we cannot cross their roads until we get a permit to cross them. So they have quite a bit of leverage to negotiate, for lack of a better word, requirements in it, and encourage them to do so.
Thank you.
Mr. Rasmussen, you, I don't think, offered Web Exhibit 1.
I made a note of that, yeah. And I guess the only, Mr. Hone, did you pre-mark exhibits?
No.
Okay, then I would offer it as Exhibit 1 then.
Is there an objection?
None from the applicant.
No objection.
Web Exhibit 1 is admitted. It is.
Mr. Smith, I might just note, and this is, of course, a unique situation, so this has to do with more of the exhibits that were offered earlier today. If we have exhibits that are offered that have not been filed with the commission in the past, if we could get copies for the commissioners, I think would be very helpful. Sometimes we have a hard time following if we can't look over.
I apologize again, Commissioner. I just really do. It's oversight on my part, and I do apologize. I know how difficult that is, and we won't let it happen again.
And you may have apologized. You probably have apologized before, in which case I missed it, and I'm sorry for beating you up so much.
Due to our reporter's schedule, we're going to adjourn for the evening, and we will reconvene at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Thank you. And you will still be on the stand, Mr. Gray.
If I might ask Mr. Smith, will the room be secured, or should we take all of our stuff with us, or that which we – what's our instruction in that regard?
It'll be locked. I mean, there will be maintenance people in here and so forth in all likelihood this evening, if you're comfortable with that. I might – you might consider laptops, doing something with those.
Mr. Smith, before we boogie here, I just want to get a feel for what the rest of the schedule for the rest of the week would look like. You know, we're starting at 8:30 on the out days outside of Tuesday.
Right.
We have a public hearing on Thursday night. Presumably we would try to wrap up at a decent hour on Friday. My hope would be that on Thursday and Wednesday we'd be able to steal a few hours from the nighttime, from the early evening, pushing it past 5 o'clock, if that's acceptable to parties. I'm not talking about working until 9. I know you've got work to do, but if we could steal even an hour or two, I think that might help us get our work done.
On Tuesday and Wednesday?
Wednesday.
Thursday we won't have because, okay.
Right, Tuesday and Wednesday, if need be, going an hour, hour and a half late.
It might be really tough for us to do that tomorrow night, but after that, I think on the applicant side we'll loosen up once our witnesses move through. We've just got a lot of work to do still, given their schedule. They were in North Dakota testifying last week at the reopened hearings there, and we've been impacted by those sorts of things. So I'd ask your indulgence in that regard, but we'll try to agree with you in what you've said. It's important to keep things moving, and I would like to do that to the extent possible. Thank you.
Okay, well, we'll play that a little bit by ear then. Thank you, everyone, and we'll see you tomorrow at 9 o'clock.